This is Advanced D&D, a podcast from WUKY, hosted by Dan Wu and DeBron Thomas. In the episode today, we're going to be talking about a lot of pop culture. We'll talk about the news and music. And let me tell you, this is the first episode since we started this podcast that we're actually recording together. We'll tell you all about it here in just a moment. This is Advanced D&D, a podcast on WUKY. Well, Dan, I know that there is nobody can see this right now, but there is about like, I don't know, like 4 inches of glass between us. But we are actually in the same building under the same roof recording this podcast together. So before we get into anything, I just want to say it's good to see you.
It's good to see you not through a digital Zoom connection.
Well, I mean, I could start, you know.
Yeah, we could glitch a little bit. I could forget to take myself off mute, I guess. I don't know how that works here.
Well, there is a cough button that I have over here. I don't think there's one on your side, but that's perfect. My mute button.
Very nice.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and get into the news because there's a lot to go over because it's been a minute. Yeah.
Yeah. Kyrsten Sinema and Joe Manchin, the two Democrats in Congress right now that somehow between the two of them wield all the power to basically put everything to a screeching halt. A lot of President Biden's agenda has been basically kind of derailed by the objections of these two lawmakers, particularly Joe Manchin, basically was able to knock out a whole bunch of environmental provisions from the budget and from Biden's plans, and which made Biden look a little bit worse than he wanted to when he went to the most recent summit this week in Glasgow on the environment. So I don't know. Like, what do you – is this just democracy at work or is there something wrong where two people can kind of derail the efforts of the other 48?
I think that one of the hot – well, it's not even really a hot take, but one of the most consistent takes I've seen on Twitter are something I agree with, and that's that this country seems to be okay with white supremacy and the way that it just continues to dominate and run over every single person. I think that if the Democratic Party had given more maybe – diverse and representative candidates that people were willing to fall on, you know, to support and actually like want to support and not vote for just cause. I think that, you know, we might have a little bit of a different situation. But I mean, we've seen the same thing happen with on the Republican side where, you know, Mitch McConnell was formerly Senate Majority Leader and had a whole bunch of power. So I think that right now this says much more about the Democrats and their actual like caring about their constituents than it does about the system. But the system definitely is the second part there.
That's right. Speaking of political representation, this past Tuesday was election day in a bunch of parts of the country. And despite the Democrats having taken a bunch of losses state and nationally, there's good news on the sort of diversity and inclusion front in terms of representation. Michelle Wu, a Taiwanese American, is the first, first woman, first any type of person of color, mayor of Boston in their 200-year history. So for 200 years, we've had just white men as mayors. Michelle Wu breaks that streak. Abdullah Hamud in Dearborn, Michigan, becomes the first Arab American, first Muslim American, Lebanese American mayor. And Aftab Puraval in nearby Cincinnati is the first Asian American and Indian American mayor. So mayors of three, you know, not insignificant cities represented by folks that we've never seen before gives you a little bit of hope.
I saw something this morning that, you know, that Michelle Wu broke a 199-year streak.
Yeah.
For 199 years, apparently they're just That's all you could do. But I do want to say that I really appreciate people from different backgrounds who run for political office, because whether they win or lose, it's a win for everyone, for us to just be able to see ourselves. But this is a big deal.
Yeah, it absolutely is. What I also enjoy about it is that Michelle Wu won in a city that is not anywhere close to majority Asian American or even have a huge Asian American population. So it's not just about, hey, I'm in a Asian heavy town, therefore, you know, we can get elected. That it goes a little bit beyond that. She apparently beat her opponent by something like 28 points. Pretty incredible. And I believe she won just about every demographic. In other news, Frances Haugen, the Facebook whistleblower, she has been testifying to governments in Europe. So this whole sort of scrutiny of Facebook has gotten really, really heated. Facebook also recently, Zuckerberg also recently, has rebranded the parent company and is no longer called Facebook. It is called Meta. And between all the memes that I've seen on the internet, I actually don't entirely know which ones are the real Zuckerberg quotes or the real Zuckerberg videos. There's some really funny stuff out there. There's one that says, if you die in the metaverse, you die in real life. And there's a part of me that I'm still like scratching my head, like, did he actually say that? Maybe? I don't know. On a personal note, man, Facebook algorithms are just absolutely killing me. And I'm not, you know, I'm not saying necessarily the things that I post on Facebook are like terrific, you know, things, but what I've noticed over the past few years is the stuff I post that is, you know, mild-mannered, rational, reasonable, you know, local things get no traction whatsoever compared to, you know, I have way more Facebook friends now than I did a couple of years ago, and my posts are getting way fewer views and likes. Because of the algorithms. And sometimes I joke, like, do I need to put hashtag stop the steal, hashtag, you know, ivermectin, you know, in all of my posts just to get some traction? It's scary and it's really infuriating.
You should try using the words rad and congratulations, because I hear that, that, you know, there's little things that pop up where you can click on them. But one of the things that I did see in relation to this rebranding was that during the video, there is a bottle of Sweet Baby Ray's just sitting on the shelf at Mark Zuckerberg's house.
Oy.
As if it's decoration. So we know he does not season his food.
Yeah. And first of all, Mark Zuckerberg still, like, you, unless you can prove to me otherwise, I still think he's like a second generation android still learning to be human. He's realized people like barbecue, so he's going to also be a human being who eats smoked meats. And Sweet Baby Ray's is apparently the barbecue sauce of the people, so he has to represent that. So yeah, it's scary and weird. In other sort of celeb news, Alec Baldwin recently on the set of a Western called Rust accidentally killed somebody with a prop gun and killed the cinematographer and injured the director. And the news that we've heard about it since, it seems like the prop master or the first assistant director have had kind of a history of just, what, irresponsibility? And for me, it immediately reminded me of Brandon Lee's death back in the 90s on the set of The Crow. So whatever you feel about Alec Baldwin, I feel real bad for him because his name is, you know, in the top of the news. His finger was on the literal trigger, though the more that comes out about it, the more it seems it was not his fault. I mean, the actors are there to act. If they get handed a prop and the prop master or the AD says, hey, this is safe, this is cold, which is what apparently was the case, you do what you do, right? And I can't imagine the trauma and the anguish that you have to feel, you know, feeling responsible for an act like that.
I mean, you know, yeah, that's something that you're going to carry with you forever. And, you know, there have been a lot of a lot of hot takes and a lot of think pieces already written. And I mean, as you said, like, the more information comes out, the messier this entire situation gets. But the reality is that somebody lost their life. And, you know, this is, from what I have seen, things like this have, people have been asking for no live weapons to be used mm-hmm. on set, whether they're loaded or not, for years. Maybe the silver lining is that this will finally maybe be the last straw. I mean, it should have been in the case of Brandon Lee for sure. But, you know.
You would think the risk outweighs the reward of, you know, because they say, like, some of the people say, like, why are we using live or real guns on set? Mm-hmm. And they're talking about it feeling realistic and all this stuff. Honestly, give me a BB gun and weigh it down. Like line that thing with lead, give it a little bit of weight. And also, it's called acting, right? You know, Leonardo DiCaprio and Kate Winslet did not have actual sex on the Titanic. They are actors. They can make it look real. It's not necessary. And if there is this amount, really any amount of this kind of risk, why go through it?
Yeah. So it's a sad situation all the way around. Well, transitioning into sports, this has been something that came out a couple of days ago. So NFL quarterback of the Green Bay Packers, Aaron Rodgers, was asked in 2019 or in August of this year, you know, when the beginning of the season, you know, are you vaccinated? And his answer was, yes, I am immunized. And then went on to talk about how, you know, getting vaccinated is a player's personal choice and this and that. Well, yesterday it was announced that he has contracted COVID-19 and is going to be out for the game against the Chiefs on Sunday. But more information came out. Turns out, apparently, he is not vaccinated and had even petitioned the NFL to do a homeopathic treatment and ask for it to be considered equal to being vaccinated. In addition to this, he has been seen hugging players, talking to players, touching players, being on the sidelines without a mask, which is something that you can do in the NFL if you are vaccinated. And he is not. As of this recording, he has not made a statement about this. But Dan, you know, like, athletes and, you know, celebrities, for the most part, whether positive or negative, they do have a platform and a responsibility to, for the most part, do the right thing. Like, what do you feel like the implications of this are moving forward?
It blows my mind that people of all levels, not just celebrities, but anybody, is willing to risk their work and careers. I mean, we've heard about people who are in workplaces that have vaccine mandates who are quitting or being fired because of it. And I guess Hill to Die On is kind of the apt metaphor here. But, like, that's what you're choosing. You're choosing a scientifically, logically erroneous stance and a socially irresponsible attitude enough to risk your job, your work, your reputation. And so for somebody like Aaron Rodgers, for somebody of that level of fame, like, does he not realize what the implication could be? Or do people in those kind of positions of power just kind of don't care, or they think they're immune, or they think that this will be fine?
Yeah, I mean, one thing that one kind of conversation on a sidebar that did come up a couple weeks ago was this whole conversation of whether or not Drake and Michael Jackson are, like, equals in terms, like, is Drake bigger than Michael mm-hmm. Jackson? The answer is no. Mm-hmm. And I think that the case for Michael Jackson is that he was literally the most well-known person on the planet and mm-hmm. had so much power and influence. And I really don't think anyone should have that amount of, like, mm-hmm. that, you know, whether they're doing good or not, like, nobody should have that much power. So it is a thing to think about, especially in these times.
Coming into more local news, boy, oh boy, Hazard, high school in Hazard, for their homecoming, you would think The Onion or somebody made this stuff up. Apparently, they had students at homecoming. These are high school children, minors, girls dressed up as basically like Hooters waitresses slash strippers, and boys dressed up also like female strippers with little tops and stuff, doing lap dances for members of the faculty, including the principal, Donald Happy Mobilini, who also happens to be the mayor of Hazard. This is what we call a shit show. This is a classic shit show. And again, the more we learn about it, the more it seems that Mr. Mayor slash principal has had other issues of being basically an irresponsible adult. There was a 2019 lawsuit based on him not protecting students during a chaperoning a trip somewhere else where one of the high school girls was assaulted. So it's like I'm just eagerly awaiting something worse coming out of Florida to take the heat off of Kentucky, because this is the kind of stuff that you see that makes the last page of the national news, where you just kind of like cover your eyes and pretend for a second that you're not also from Kentucky.
I mean, man, it really, yeah, I've kind of stayed far away from this because I've seen a lot of people write some really thoughtful, things that have a lot more eloquent ways to talk about this than I do. But I think that all of the context is everything, right? Like, the fact that this happened is terrible. But the fact that the context you just added of, you know, this person already kind of having a situation of not protecting kids, like, what were we really doing? Like, and that is one thing that just frustrates me more than anything. It's like, we want to talk about, oh, well, we got to ban critical race theory, which isn't even taught in, you know, not in a high academic level. Well, we can't have all of these things going on, but this is okay.
Yeah. Yeah. And it goes to show you that accountability is a real, you know, flippy floppy kind of thing, that if somebody has this kind of record and yet he's still, you know, been elected to mayor and yet he's still the principal of the school, allowing what I'm trying to think of what that meeting was like that approved this. Hey, you know what we should do for homecoming is get all of our minor children to dress up as essentially exotic dancers slash sex workers and give lap dances to the adults. Like, that sounds fun and appropriate. Yeesh. So hopefully there will be some actual accountability on not just the principal, but like other, other adults involved.
I'm just saying, like, you know, going back to one thing we talk about all the time, you know, great power, great responsibility. Mm-hmm. And that's that failure in that right there. Well, moving into music, what you got for us this week, Dan?
I was very excited to pick up the brand new record from War on Drugs. It's called We Don't Live Here Anymore on beautiful blue vinyl. They're a band that in the past, their past albums, I love them, but I can't latch onto them. They don't, for me, have a certain kind of hook. Like, if you told me to hum one of their songs or, like, sing one of their songs to you, it would be going, huh, huh, nah, nah. You know what I mean? Like, for some reason, I can't grab onto the lyrics, but somehow I still love them. I have kind of a random, question. So this album was a double vinyl, beautiful blue vinyl. And maybe this is just like partly a generational thing, partly a technology thing. If I put on their album on Spotify on my, Bluetooth speaker, I can listen to the whole album uninterrupted. Here, I have to get up at least three times to flip the record. And sometimes, and a couple of the sides, there are like two songs or like three songs. Help me play devil's advocate here. Why is that good? Could they not have crammed the album onto one record? I don't know.
I don't know that I can answer why it is good, but I can offer some context. When it comes to putting things on vinyl, and releasing things on vinyl. There's an entirely different process needed to press it and also mix it. So that could be, and master it. So that could be a reason why it is the way that it is, but also it could be an artistic choice. And, you know, I don't know. Because I saw on Twitter today someone was complaining about Prince's album Love Sexy, and that, you know, now in this world we can listen to the album track by track. But when it came out, it was one continuous track, and you flipped it over to the other side, and that was the other side of the record. So I don't know. I mean, I think that there is definitely some creative license there. But in terms of actually getting it, you know, pressed onto vinyl, it is a different process that requires a lot more work than it would for, you know, actually getting something on a CD or something like that. So I don't know. I don't know if it's good or not, but I think that's my two cents on it.
Yeah. In some ways too, like, it feels like artistic intent in terms of what the artist is saying, this is how you should listen to the album versus sort of a choose your own adventure sort of lifestyle of the consumer. Like, if I want to listen to just a few songs off this album, I can. Another great example is Lauryn Hill's Miseducation of Ms. Lauryn Hill, where there are all these little skits like at the ends of all these songs that, you know, when I'm playing in the car on Spotify, I can like skip. Back when I was listening to stuff on iTunes, I actually edited them so that I would cut these little skit parts out, because it just, for me, it just broke the tempo and the mood of listening to the album. But if you put on the actual record, you kind of have to suffer through this weird little chit chat and little jokes and things like that. So it's like, I don't know, like I can respect the artist, but I also like, I feel like it's in my house, it's my product, and I should be able to consume it the way I want.
Yeah. I mean, I think that from an artistic standpoint, like, I'm just like, hey, like, you know, I will let it play the way that the artist intended. But, you know, speaking specifically to that album, the best song on that album wasn't on any of the digital areas, because it was an extra track on on the song Tell Him. I love that song. Mm-hmm. Like, you put that song on, I'm going to cry every single time. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I think that's also part of the reason why, you know, some people release different remixes. And, you know, as I guess on the radio side, I also get to see some of the, this is the radio version.
Right.
Well, you know, one of my favorite guitar players is a Memphis guitar legend by the name of Eric Gales. And he has had quite an incredible story. He was a child prodigy and, ran into issues with drug abuse, and also being a black guitar player wasn't necessarily given a lot of the same attention that a lot of his contemporaries were. He's been clean for a few years, and he's making some of the best music that he's ever made. But there is a video a couple weeks ago, I guess it was last week, he played with Gary Clark Jr. in Greensboro, North Carolina. And there is a video of them doing When My Train Pulls In. And Dan, I don't know, you know, if this is your experience with music, but for me, it very much is a spiritual experience. Mm. And watching this dude play guitar on this song, it just, you feel every note that, you know, it's like every time he plays guitar, it's like he's playing it for the last time. Mm. And this particular like video, like when I started, I saw it on Facebook, then I saw the original poster, put it on YouTube. And at that point it was like, you know, there were like 100 likes. I looked at this last night, it's over 300,000 views already. I highly recommend it. And that is my music for the week. Eric Gales and Gary Clark Jr. doing When My Train Pulls In.
Nice.
Well, moving to one of my favorite segments this week in Anderson .Paak, old Brandon, Cheeky Andy, has had quite a week. We're coming on the other side of Halloween, so one of the first things I got to talk about is, I don't know if you've seen these, but he recreated the album covers of Prince's self-titled record, Stevie Wonder's Hotter Than July, and Bruno Mars's 24K Magic. And they're all incredible, and like the just... Even like when he does the Prince album, he even had like fake chest hair. Like it's incredible. Also, the Silk Sonic album drops next Friday, the 12th. So that is like something I'm super excited about. And then another thing that just came out this week. He has partnered with Universal Media Group to create Ape Shit Records. It's his new record label that he has stated is supposed to be for artists with chops. So that's a lot going on this week, but Andy's had a great week, and that has been This Week in Anderson .Paak.
I just pulled up the Anderson .Paak Stevie Wonder. That's pretty fantastic. It basically tricks you until you see the tattoos, and you're like, wait, did Stevie have that many tattoos? In the same post, there's Lizzo as Grogu, as Baby Yoda. So that's something. And then also on Instagram this week, I saw Janelle Monáe as the Grinch. Must be nice having world-class Hollywood-level like makeup artists and costumers as your friends and contacts to just throw something together just for fun for Halloween.
Well, since I know how much you love the Met Gala as well,
yes.
Lizzo also recreated Kim Kardashian's outfit. So there is that.
That's great.
Well, let's roll into TV and movies. It's been a minute since we've had a chance to talk about things, and I know the big thing we'll talk about this week is Dune. But I'll go ahead and let you go first.
Yeah, saw a bunch of stuff. We'll start with the smaller ones. I watched this little, what was this from? I think it was a French film called Raw. Actually, this is so weird because I feel like I've seen too many things in different languages recently. I can't even remember if it's French or in English. It's this little tiny indie horror movie where this young lady is going to veterinary school and she's a vegan. And then during a hazing ritual, they force her to eat like a little like raw rabbit liver. And then it turns out she's a cannibal. So really kind of fun, kind of weird. A lot of really kind of interesting things that it says about sort of how women view their bodies, how men view women's bodies. Just interesting little film on Netflix called Raw. Got to catch the new Wes Anderson movie, French Dispatch. I feel like I don't have the ability to critique Wes Anderson anymore. I feel like he lives in his own little diorama world, and the critiques that I have of Wes Anderson feel, I don't know, like off base or pointless, like because I would be critiquing Wes Anderson for being too Wes Anderson, and this is probably the most Wes Anderson movie yet, just meticulously production design to death, that sprawling A-list cast, many of whom are part of his repertoire, folks like Jason Schwartzman and Owen Wilson and Bill Murray and folks. But really interesting, really great turn from Jeffrey Wright. Nice to hear that Brasso, you know, watcher voice come through. Your feelings about Wes Anderson in general?
I have some feelings about Wes Anderson because of the way that sometimes his films will fall into tropes or not necessarily be particularly diverse. But, you know, when you were talking about harping on Wes Anderson for being too Wes Anderson, I want to remind you that that John Fogerty once was sued by the members of Creedence for sounding too much like Creedence, even though he is Creedence. So, I don't think that that's too out of left field. But I really do enjoy the way that he just doesn't care at this point. And I think, you know, take it or leave it from an artistic standpoint, like, there's a lot to take from that. That's really nice.
Yeah. It feels like he's his own genre. To say that he doesn't have a versatile voice, again, also feels like it's missing the point. And to some weird degree, you know me, you and I think we look critically at pop culture in terms of representation, in terms of race, in terms of all these sort of factors. To some degree, critiquing Wes Anderson for being too white also feels off base now. Like, I don't know how he's getting a pass in my mind, but that's kind of what it feels like.
Yeah, I don't know. We've all got our own internal biases. I'm right there with you because I'm like, I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. Let's talk about What If. We finished off the finale, and to me it was very satisfying. The series started off as, to me, kind of fun and throwaway and inconsequential, And then I think starting from the zombie episode, it really kind of really hit me. And I love that zombie episode still. And then it kind of really all came together in a very unexpected way. Love Jeffrey Wright once again, that great voice. If somebody's ever going to sort of take on the mantle of Morgan Freeman as narrator of our entire lives, it'll be him, except he lends a little bit of sort of sardonic humor, a little bit of sort of darkness that Morgan Freeman does not. But yeah, overall, I like it a lot, and I'm curious to see how it ties into the greater MCU.
Well, and I think especially with the way that... Okay, so I'm going to tie into something real quick here, because this whole conversation around the multiverse started, you know, with Loki, and it has dripped so far into even now Venom. So I think that there are going to be a lot of surprises in the Marvel Universe kind of going forward, especially when we follow this whole Jonathan Majors as Kang the Conqueror. Mm-hmm. But kind of keeping it to what if, I think that what had been said was these characters, you know, the door, you know, it's open for any of them mm-hmm. to return. I have to get in my feelings for just a minute because it was very mm-hmm. sad to finally say goodbye to Chadwick Boseman mm-hmm. as T'Challa. Whether they get another voice actor to continue that character is to be determined. I know that they have said they're not going to recast him in the movies. But I thought that overall, like the... just kind of like the twists and turns, especially like how in the universe with Black Widow and Hawkeye, like Hawkeye was the one that sacrificed himself. Mm-hmm. They just did so good mm-hmm. with just mm-hmm. weaving this, because the individual stories were cool. I mean, there were some that were not really as great as others, but when it comes to the story as a whole, the way that it all came together, it was just absolutely incredible. Mm-hmm. One of my favorite shows came back recently, and that is Insecure, the final season with Issa Rae and, many other people. The first episode of this new season was actually filmed and shot on the campus of Stanford University. I grew up very close to there. Mm-hmm. So for me, it was a little nostalgia. But I just, you know, I think we talked about this before, like watching Insecure, I realized something that I don't ever want to take for granted again, but the way that they light black people mm-hmm. in that show mm-hmm. correctly, like I didn't realize that most of what I had seen was not done that way.
Yeah.
And you know, it's just little things that it's like the story is great, but then when you get to see things physically, it really makes you feel valued, yeah. I think.
Yeah. It makes you really, really realize that representation is not just about who's in front of the screen or who's on the mic. It's who's behind the controls and who's behind the scenes in terms of writing characters that are real, in terms of directing actors in a way that's genuine and authentic, and literally being seen, like being seen on screen, knowing, you know, and I think this is kind of a movement that's happening in photography as well, and makeup as well, of actually realizing like, yeah, it's a different kind of thing to put makeup on a black person or a person of color. It's a different thing to light and to photograph them.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, this conversation that came up a couple of years ago around really well-known black actresses not being able to get like to do having to do their own hair for movies and mm-hmm. things like that, that mm-hmm. blew my mind. I was mm-hmm. like, I mean, obviously, I see why this is a problem, but really, Hollywood can't find mm-hmm. people who... Anyway, Star Wars Visions was definitely one of my favorite things. I know we talked about it a little bit before we got to this, but I just, for more than anything, I just loved the fact that Star Wars as a whole rips off... well, borrows mm-hmm. a lot from mm-hmm. the mythos of Akira Kurosawa and a lot of other Japanese filmmakers. So it was really, really nice to finally see Japanese animation studios get to do their own thing, not connected to canon. You know, they didn't have to worry about tying into what is canon or not, and they just got to tell some really cool stories, and I thought they were really beautiful. And I know you had a chance to watch some of the episodes.
Yeah, I watched a few episodes. It didn't hit me quite as well because I'm generally speaking not an anime fan. I know a few of the sort of canonical things like Akira and things like that. But generally speaking, like the references, the styles didn't really like echo with me because I just don't know that genre very well. But you're right. I love the fact that hopefully this reminds watchers of Star Wars that nothing is original, and there's so much, whether you call it appropriation or homage, there's so much in sort of the Chambara samurai, you know, genre that that Star Wars riffs from. This, you know, the example I always give was when I was in college, the first time I heard Parliament Funkadelic, and I think it was Atomic Dog, and I was like, wait, this is that Snoop song? And then I was like, wait, and you know, it was just like this little window opening up in my mind. And what I hope is a series like Star Wars Visions opens up other folks who, you know, maybe younger watchers or just they know Star Wars, they know American stuff, and suddenly realize like, oh, yeah, that's a thing. I'm going to go explore that and see what these roots are.
So kind of that seems like a perfect transition into Dune, which has a lot of those within it in all of the iterations because, the, you know, from the books, there's a lot of Middle Eastern mythology that was borrowed. But, you know, I wish I had gone to see this in theaters because, I mean, I know you did, mm-hmm. But I can't wait for the sequel to come out and then just sit in the theater for like 7 hours in an IMAX. Mm. I will pay all the money that, you know, because it is a film that definitely needs to be seen, you know, and heard in a huge environment.
Yeah, absolutely agree. One of the central characters of this movie is the world, Arrakis, and these huge sand dunes and these giant gargantuan, you know, buildings and these, refinery things and the sandworms, of course. The scale of this thing is humongous. I was optimistic from the get-go when I heard that Denis Villeneuve was going to be the director because he's always been a really great at what I would consider cerebral, well-thought-out science fiction and speculative fiction, having done Blade Runner 2049, is that the year? And Arrival, and also some, you know, smaller indie stuff, Sicario, things like that. He's always been a very serious-minded director, and I thought that was very much the right approach. The cast is impeccable. There was a lot to load in because the mythology of Herbert is so thick, so thick that you really need, I mean, you could break that first book into like 10 movies and still be able to do really well with it. So I thought they did what they had to do with it. I, having read Dune and having seen the Lynch movie in the 80s, like, you know, you got some good bases to walk in and not be too confused. But I thought the action set pieces were terrific. The production design was amazing. The costuming was great. I am curious to see, especially in the second part of it, how Villeneuve deals with, as a director, the kind of the central problem of Dune, which is that white savior narrative, that sort of Jesus figure, the one literal messiah, they call him a messiah, character who comes in, you know, from a civilized white world, comes into this sort of desert, primitive, full of noble savages, basically, world, and becomes their leader. So I'm curious to see how he navigates that, because I think he will try to navigate it in a new way that's not, you know, based on something that was written 50, 60 years ago.
I mean, I agree with you there, especially given with how diverse the mm-hmm. cast was. Not just people in the background, but like main characters. Mm-hmm. Just how, like Javier Bardem and Zendaya for... Mm-hmm. Not very long, but yeah. You know, Jason Momoa. I mean, mm-hmm. they're like the cat, like, and of course, I have to give some love to Oscar Isaac because mm-hmm. that dude can play anything as he far can. As I'm concerned.
And what a gorgeous, gorgeous beard.
Yes.
So good.
I mean, look, I have I have a lot of feelings about Jason Momoa in terms of him being a beautiful man and everything, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. no, it was definitely Oscar yeah. Isaac in this film.
Yeah.
Well, I look forward to seeing where the movie goes forward with the sequel. It's unfortunate that they were not able to shoot the films back to back because I think that Timothée Chalamet is probably going to be like most people his age and look 14 until he's about
true.
You know, 22, and then oh hey, here's a grown man, you know.
Yeah.
But we'll see what happens.
Yeah, we've got time for that. In terms of books this week, I've been I don't know. I feel like my mind is not as focused and doesn't have the kind of bandwidth that it used to for reading. So, of course, I always fall back on graphic novels. Recently, I've been visiting and revisiting some kind of crime noir stuff by this really terrific pairing of Ed Brubaker and Sean Phillips. They do the Criminal series, and I think there's one called... I don't know. It's like Live or Die, death, guns, shooting, murder, things like that. And the most recent series I've been reading is Reckless. The artwork is great. It's very like old school kind of film noir-ish stuff. And again, it's one of those things where, I don't know, I feel like my thoughts are evolving on it because you look at their stuff and it's by and large also very white. And they're, you know, they're starting from the basis of crime, you know, film noir, which is a very white genre. And so I sometimes wonder, like, my general critique of things not being diverse enough kind of applies to everything. But then I feel like there are certain things that I'm starting to make exceptions for, and I don't know how to exactly grapple with what's going on in my head.
Well, I just need you to know that when you said film noir is not necessarily diverse, I'm like, yeah, they shoot it in black and white, though, yeah. That counts for something.
That counts for something, yeah. But again, it's one of those things where it is a genre where, you know, if you can do, and I don't think Dune was what I would say is colorblind casting. They did more intentional casting. But I think with something like the film noir genre or the crime genre, especially taking in modern times, and he sets his stuff in modern times in the 80s and the 60s, so it kind of doesn't matter. You could completely do a much more diverse and inclusive cast, especially also because you're drawing it. Like, it's not going to cost you any more money to have black characters than white characters. So, yeah, it would be good, but also I feel weirdly forgiving about it. I don't know. The other good read that I did was a kind of a minor work by Stephen King called The Long Walk. I'm a sucker for just like an interesting premise. So this takes place, I think it was written in the 70s. And they're apparently in this world, which is like a normal, like our world. But teenage boys can enter this lottery to go on this long marathon walk. And literally, they are not allowed to stop walking or slow down to a certain pace, or they literally will be shot and killed. And then the one who wins, that survives all the way to the end, they get, quote unquote, anything they want. And that's the entire premise. So the whole thing is told from the point of view of all these teenage boys. And it's just like kind of a grueling read. But also it's Stephen King. So it just like zips along really well. So again, I'm going to keep saying this and sound dumb every time I say it. But that's Stephen King. He can write.
He can do it.
He's all right.
Yeah, he can tweet too. So there's...
Yeah, that's true.
Shifting into pandemic advice, I have one, and I, you know, Dan, I'm going to be honest here. When I got vaccinated, I felt very, guilty, because of the time in which I was vaccinated, only happened at the time because I am an employee of the University of Kentucky. And I know there were a lot of people, who might have been in a different health situation than I am, I felt a lot of guilt mm-hmm. with as many people as do, you know, as have not taken the vaccine at this point. My feelings about that have changed. Mm-hmm. I don't feel guilty. If that's your choice, that is your choice. My pandemic advice though, is I recently got my booster shot and, it was, it took me out for a couple of days. Mm-hmm. So my advice this week is if you are getting your booster, please do what you can to make sure that you have a lot of things that you need at home. And, you know, maybe don't plan anything for the next 3 days, because it took me 3 days to get through it. Mm. And I didn't have very many side effects to the second shot. So, if you're getting that booster, you know, go get your booster and then, you know, find a comfortable place to be, because it's going to be a ride.
Yeah, I've heard that from a few other friends as well. So set yourself up with a couple of days off coming up if you can, and queue up Money Heist, because that'll eat up some of your time. And I can't stop raving about Money Heist. The finale season is coming up in December, so looking forward to talking about that. In terms of my pandemic advice, vaccines have just been approved for 5 to 11-year-olds, which a lot of parents have been eagerly waiting for. Go get it as soon as it's available. I think the most readily available places will be to talk to your pediatricians and schedule it, but I'm pretty sure at some point the Kroger's and the Walgreens and everybody's gonna have it. If you can go get a shot, whether it's a booster, a first shot, or a shot for your kid, go get it.
And, you know, continue to mask up. That's also an important thing. Well, you know, Dan, this is weird for me, but this brings us to a close. This is the first show that we have done since we started this, where we're actually like in the same building, mm-hmm. not in the same room, but we're in the same building, mm-hmm. and that's, you know, baby steps. So until next time, please, you know, do what you can. Take care of yourself, and we'll see you soon.
Bye-bye.